Hello, welcome to the Paradox Podcast. We once again have a special guest in studio at Paradox World Headquarters here in Redlands. Please welcome the one and only Garrett Spire.
I feel welcomed.
Are you still a guest if you come back a second time or a third time?
Potentially a fourth.
Yeah, when do you stop being a guest?
I mean, I don't mind being a guest every time.
Well, Garrett's here. Last week we did this format where he asked me some questions about my sermon, and we talked about the worst speaking gig ever and some other things along the way. So Garrett's going to do the same thing. Once again, these are questions that Garrett has written. I don't know any of them ahead of time, and Garrett's just going to launch into it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think we should begin by saying this sermon didn't really tackle much theologically, right? You know, maybe we talked a little bit. We kind of dabbled in police brutality and then dealt a bit with the New Testament potentially undermining the Old Testament, bit about hermeneutics. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we're going to have enough to talk about today.
Yeah. But well,
we'll try.
It was a hard one to write, is all I will say.
Yeah.
It was very hard to write.
No, I think there's a lot here, and I'm sure there's a lot of questions that people had leaving the sermon, which is good, right? Mm-hmm. What's the quote? The sermon is not meant to end
a
discussion.
We try not to end the discussion with sermons. We strive to start discussions with.
That
up.
Was it. No,
it's almost like I've never said it. At Paradox, we believe that sermons are meant to begin discussions rather than end them.
Exactly, that's and what I'm I think. Trying to say. You met your goal. That was is a great talk. You know, I'll say this. I want to address the listener because I think you have a ability of being able to speak to a broad range of listeners, people who may come from maybe a more fundamentalist background, someone who's always grown up in the church, and then also the person who maybe doesn't even know if they believe in God necessarily. So a question that I had is that we see the writer of Hebrews predominantly use this metaphor of a high priest.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get into the ideas of metaphors later, but what would you say to somebody who's like, I can't even get on Jesus being divine? Like, that's where I stop. Yeah. That's where I get off the train. And so if the whole purpose of Hebrews is to prove this point that this is who Jesus is. Mm-hmm. Jesus matters because of his divinity. And I don't even think Jesus was divine. Why does the book of Hebrews even matter to me? What does it even have mm-hmm. to say to maybe somebody who thinks like that?
Well, that's an excellent question. The truth is I cannot, no matter how much I want to, prove to someone else that Jesus was in fact divine. There's no way for me to. And I think the church has spent a lot of energy trying to prove things that are simply unprovable. Hmm. And even then, when you look at the writing of Hebrews, he spends one chapter talking about how Jesus is the divine Son of God. And then he spends the rest of the book, or the other 12 chapters of his writing, talking about why that matters. And so, yeah, we could debate back and forth as to whether or not Jesus is the Son of God. But what he says, this is why it matters, is he says, if that's true, then all of the universe is a generous place rather than a scarce place. He says, then basically the foundation of the universe is love and not fear or death. He talks about how we then approach death not from fear, but approach death with confidence and understand that's part of the way the universe works. And so he says, if this whole Son of God thing is true, then it changes everything. So if somebody were to come to me and say, like, I just can't get on board with the Son of God, all this stuff, you know, being divine, I'd say, okay. I mean, once again, I can't prove or disprove that. But if somebody were to say, how is it that you made it through that really tough time in your life with how did you survive in that? I would cite my faith because it's usually my weakness that I'm able to cite my faith and point to that. And it's that faith that I believe that Jesus is the Son of God.
Nice. Yeah, I like that answer. Do you mind if I ask you personally why the divinity of Christ matters to you personally?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't mind. Although, give me a second to think of a good answer.
Yeah.
It's really being able to trust in the goodness of humanity. And when I look at the book of Hebrews, it is a reaffirmation of the goodness of this human existence. And we started last week by talking about how to be human was to be good. And then this week we talked about how if Jesus is our high priest, then that means that the universe is a good place. And it's hard to believe the universe is a good place when there's a lot of evil that happens within the world. I mean, you know, I've just been overwhelmed with all of the allegations of sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual misconduct. I mean, it's hard to believe that human beings can actually be good. But if people were to say, like, why is it that you wouldn't give up on human beings? I would say, me personally, I don't give up on human beings because I believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that humans are worthwhile and that, and they are at their core good.
Nice. That's an excellent off-the-cuff answer.
it's a tricky, it's a very personal thing.
Exactly.
And at the same time, I think that's what faith is supposed to be. And we often make it this geometric proof that if A, then B, then B, then C, then exactly. All this stuff. But it comes down to testimony.
Yeah.
Right?
Very true.
It comes down to how do you walk with it in the midst of uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think what struck me is that how many different definitions of divinity you could find in the Bible of why that matters to the author.
Yeah.
Like, clearly it matters for the author of Hebrews because he's trying to... I don't know if correct's the right word, but move forward someone's, the reader's consciousness regarding the theology of Leviticus, mm-hmm. as opposed to, the theology that the idea that the author of Hebrews is trying to present, right?
Yeah.
So clearly that's why the divinity matters to this author.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's really his thrust. But I mean, I think if you were to go to Matthew, he would have a completely different take on it. And even Luke. And so, like you said, it is extremely personal.
Yeah. But there's the common thread that the New Testament writers all have this idea that if you trust that Jesus is the Son of God, something will fundamentally change within you.
I like that.
And what I think Christianity has done that's really distorted the picture is that if you trust that Jesus is the Son of God, God won't shoot at you or kill you.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different message. Yep. And I don't get that when I read the New Testament.
Or that your life will change later. Life's going to be great when you go to heaven.
Yeah, and it's just that whole delayed idea of like, hey, you know, really live a boring, uninteresting life. And the more bland, the better.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Like, be as bland as possible, and then you'll be so vanilla, Jesus will let you into heaven.
You'll be so vanilla.
And then you can finally have fun, right?
Exactly. That's like, when the fun starts.
And that's what really a lot of people, a lot of Christianity gains from reading the New Testament. And I read that and I hear that and I'm like, is that
good news?
Is that really it?
Yeah.
Because that sounds miserable.
Right.
And my friend Tyler, who's agnostic, he always says, he's like, why would I live a life I didn't want to live on the chance I could live a life that I wanted to live later?
Mm.
And I'm like, well,
that's good.
Well, that was my reaction all the way through architecture school.
Yeah. Dang it, Tyler.
Yeah, I know.
Nice one.
I know.
Yeah, you know, and I think there's a lot there. I want to begin by asking you a question of, do you feel like as a whole, like as a whole of Christianity, we are completely missing this idea of reading the Bible? Like, to me, you pull out this idea that Hebrews fundamentally is correcting an idea or belief that people had in the time of when Leviticus was written.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that contradiction there. So how, like, obviously you had to, the like you said, the author's assuming that you have read Leviticus. Like, what is the author assuming that I know that I may not know in 2017? And did these authors ever have this conception in their mind that their writings would transcend themselves to this degree? Mm-hmm. Do you see where I'm going? Yeah.
Yeah. So the author of Hebrews might have had that sense, never to the degree that it actually became, mm-hmm. in my opinion. Because remember, most of these people were used to reading a Bible within one racial context, which is the Jewish context.
Hmm.
So I don't think any of them pictured kind of like a global... First of all, they had no idea what California was.
Right, right.
I always say when Paul writes his writings, he never sat down to write the Bible, which means that he never sat down to write a code for what Christianity is, with possibly maybe the exception of Ephesians. Ephesians seems more vague than the others, where it feels like he's kind of changing the literary form a little bit. But other than that, he never sat down and said, I'm going to write a book that's going to set the record straight on what Christianity is. And yet, that's how a lot of people read his writings. And I still say this all the time. When people read the 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians, it's important to remember it was never written for us. We're observers in this letter. We're not the intended audience. And at that point, people say to me, they're like, well, what do you mean? Like, well, who's it written for then? And I'm like, well, the Corinthians. And there's this sense that if it's not written for me, then what's the point? Which is like the most narcissistic kind of idea. But it says right in the title, this is the letter to the Corinthians. And, I think that's why it's important to know who it is that the author is writing to. What's unique about Hebrews is we don't know who the author is. And we also don't know who this author is writing to, which makes it difficult to talk about context and the other things. You also asked about if we're missing scripture as a whole.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I would say no. The majority, though, I would say is. And I've said this before, but essentially the idea that biblical illiteracy is crippling the American church. And I really believe this because we have such a poor understanding of the way to read scripture that it's really getting us into major trouble.
Hmm.
And I don't say it's the whole because I was taught at La Sierra University. And if people have enjoyed things that we've done at Paradox or they've enjoyed my speaking, I have to give a lot of credit to my teachers at La Sierra who corrected the way that I was reading the Bible, showed me that I was reading it with a very, very poor, illiterate kind of way. And they showed me a better way of reading the Bible that considered the context and who the author was. And they made the Bible more and more human, more over and over again. And I found it incredibly valuable.
That's good. Something that struck me is when I thought about the implications of the idea that there are literally contradictions within scripture, mm-hmm. of how different I grew up reading the Bible. I grew up with you know, going to like these Revelation Daniel seminars multiple times a year, where the sermon begins with an idea that you don't even know if it's in the Bible, first off, right? It's just an idea. And so the idea is, for example, that Sunday is not the right day to have church on, right? Saturday is that day. That's their premise. Where is that found in scriptures? I'm not exactly sure still to this day. You know, if you were to like find that whole principle, and what the pastor would continue to do is he would work through a chapter or sometimes multiple chapters and pull a verse, even parts of verses, to essentially affirm his point, mm-hmm. right? And if you read the Bible like that, you can literally make it say anything you want it to say.
I really believe you can. I agree with that 100%. You can make it say whatever you want. And when you look at the book of Hebrews, there's some pretty dark verses, but they're always in the context of hope. And you cannot deny that Hebrews is written as a work and a word of hope more than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, did it ever at any point, like clearly it doesn't now, but maybe the person who had never realized that there's two creation accounts within Genesis, like some of the contradictions in the Bible and that those accounts mm-hmm. are different, like fundamentally different. When they heard that Hebrews like fundamentally undermines the theology of Leviticus, it just like blew their mind, and it really it really threw them into maybe a sort of I don't know, a dark night of the soul. And they're like, well, what do I do with the Bible now? What would you say to that?
I would say you're not alone. I've been through the same thing. So I when I was in Waneel Kim's class, who was my Old Testament professor, and he spoke about the contradictions of the Bible, I'd never heard any of that before. And it took me all the way till I was a graduate school in theology.
Why is that? Why do we not hear these things?
Because it's really tricky. It's really tricky to talk about. I mean, I got removed from a job, right?
So like, right.
I'll tell you, when you talk about it, people don't like you bringing them up.
Yeah.
Because people, I really believe that people want a religion. The majority of people want a religion that doesn't ask them to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of affirms them and says they're good and things are good. And there's a place for that, right?
Right.
There's a point where people are broken and they need to be reminded they're good.
Mm-hmm.
But a contradiction, I was always taught to run away from those or not to trust when somebody said the Bible had a contradiction.
Right.
I found there to be the most inspiration and beauty and humanity within those contradictions.
Talk about that a little more.
Yeah. So when you come across contradiction, let's take one that's really obvious. There's mm-hmm. one in 2 Samuel. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, it's in 2 Samuel, where it talks about how David took a census
okay.
of the people, and it's considered one of David's great sins because he's basically taking stock of what his power is.
Okay.
In 2 Samuel, it says that David was tempted by God to take the census. And then about 400 to 500 years later, we have 1 and 2 Chronicles being written. And so much has changed between the time that 1 and 2 Samuel is written and 1 and 2 Chronicles that the theology has changed.
Hmm.
And when it records the story in 1 Chronicles, telling the story about David taking the census, 1 Chronicles records that David was tempted by Satan, not by God, which is a major contradiction.
Yeah.
That's not like one of those minor sort of contradictions. It's either God or Satan, right? Like you can't have them be both.
What's the Hebrew there? Like maybe there's
no, Hebrew. It's different, two different names. No, I laugh because everybody, when people hear this, they're like, well, I got to research. I'm
right.
Like, I understand. That's the exact same reaction I would have had, but you can't.
Satan. God.
Yeah. It's a big deal whether Satan tempted him or God,
did.
Him,
absolutely.
Right?
Like absolutely.
That's just not up for debate whether that's the same person or not. And you know, you used to be afraid of that, but then you say, so what changed between, you know, 700 BCE to 200 BCE? And the truth is they didn't really have any idea of what Satan was before about 500 BCE. So Satan finally shows up once they've been in Babylon, and Ha-Satan is a Babylonian god called the Shiny One that tricks and tempts people, much like Loki in Norse mythology. And there's people that started adopting that to within their understanding and the way of being of who God was. Now, this freaks people out because they're starting to worry that the Bible isn't a 100% inerrant, perfect witness.
Right.
And I'll tell you, I felt that same fear as well. But once I finally let go of that, I found the Bible was far more interesting than it was before.
You kind of were able to allow the Bible to be what it actually is.
Yeah. And my testimony is the minute that I gave up the inerrancy of the Bible is the moment I actually enjoyed reading it. And the moment I actually read it as opposed to pretended to read it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it was easy. It was really easy for me to keep up this idea that the Bible is the perfect inerrant word of God. And as long as I didn't read it. And the case in point is this Leviticus Hebrews thing. There is no doubt in my mind this Hebrews author was 100% challenging the ideology and theology of Leviticus.
And that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful that those two sit in the same book.
Yeah.
I love that. I also thought it was amazing that I never thought about the idea of Joshua taking this idea of God with us and being God only with my tribe, like sort of like a step back in consciousness, a sort of tribal identity, tribal God, God's, this is my God, not yours. And yet the writers, you know, this, the people who decided on what was going to be included in the scriptures were like, yeah,
put it in. And this is what I love. This is what I love about the Hebrew Bible, because the Hebrew Bible is this even better than the New Testament. They do a lot better job of including flaws and shortcomings and just like the badness of humanity of their own tribe better than just about any religious writing out there.
Yeah.
And I mean, the prophets are the Jews saying to themselves, we're idiots. We're hypocrites.
Right.
We never should have gotten this blessing in the first place.
Hmm.
And they said, yeah, put that in.
Yeah.
And that blows my mind.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Like I would never put that in.
That's a good point. Yeah. It includes self-critique.
Yeah.
With it. Yeah.
And let me tell you something about Joshua too. Cause a lot of people think I have a secret agenda to remove books from the Bible. I don't. Like I want everyone to know I don't have that secret agenda. I've never campaigned to remove Joshua. I think Joshua's bad theology.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Right. Don't take it out of the Bible though.
Yeah, and isn't that really important to understanding the role Joshua plays in the Bible?
Sure, and we see Joshuan, I don't know how to say that.
Yeah.
Joshuan theology, we see it all around us. Whenever a country says, God is on our side, let's go bomb the crap out of other people, that's Joshua's theology.
Wow.
And we can recognize that and say, hey, we've done this before. We have done this before.
Right.
It doesn't lead us to a good place.
Exactly.
And all of that history and all of those First and Second Kings and Judges is a result of Joshua's violent campaign. So I wish that we would say like, oh, no, we know this because it's in our Bible. We probably shouldn't say God is on our side as we drop bombs on other children of God.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Great point. I want to talk a bit about the idea of metaphor. And an author that we mentioned last podcast and one that we both love refers to God. We only can refer to the divine in metaphor. That's the only language we can use to speak of God.
Yeah, you're referring to Richard Rohr, which I'm pretty sure will come up every time we talk.
Probably. I assume he will.
Yeah.
We should call this Garrett Interviews Craig about Richard Rohr.
Yeah, that's about right. About right.
But I'd like to talk to you. I'd just ask you any questions about the power of metaphor and what role metaphor can play in our reading of the scripture.
Yeah. So in Revelation, which is not my favorite book of the Bible.
Mine either. Yeah.
You've been to all the seminars too.
I've been to a ton.
Did they always come to the same conclusion at the seminars of Daniel and Revelation?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think if you try to treat Revelation like we're talking about it, like literarily, I think is the right word.
Yeah.
Like actually realize that this is a book full of metaphors, and consider the context, consider the audience, all the things you're talking about. You're not going to fit in with the crowd.
No,
your sermon is going to be of a completely different type of nature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So John is using this metaphor, but hold on, wait. That's a literal beast with literal horns and somehow it translates to Catholics.
Well, it's funny because it's a literal interpretation of a metaphor.
Exactly.
Where they're like, that beast means this and nothing else, period. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Who died and made you the ability?
Exactly.
Give you the ability to distinguish that.
Right. Yeah. 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 Good point.
Well,
so
before I jump into Revelation, I don't know if I've told you this.
No, please.
But, when we did this Bible series originally, I had Revelation dead last. It was an 8-year Bible series plan, right? When I was still working for the Adventist Church. And I had Revelation dead last because I was like, that one might fire me. It might get me fired, right?
You knew?
Yeah, I just knew it. And then I was asked by the church to do a Revelation series because they weren't sure I was Adventist. And so I was like, all right.
Here we go.
And we did it. And like 6 months later, I was gone.
That was it.
They could never recover from that one because it was so...
Do you mind talking about are you okay talking about some of the ideas that were challenging to people?
Yeah. So there was this idea that God saves a small select group of people. And that's something that a lot of Christians believe in.
Hmm.
But when we've been to places where massive amounts of population are wiped out, we don't celebrate that as a manifestation of who God is. Instead, we go there and it's usually a memorial, and we go there and we remember and we reflect and we pause. So for instance, if you've been to Dachau in Germany, I went there in 2007.
Yeah.
And it's not this place where I'm like, oh man, this is where God was seen and felt. And it's the exact opposite. I was like, oh, this is hell on earth.
Right. Exactly.
And yet that's exactly what people are campaigning for.
Huh.
Another example is I went to Hiroshima in 2011. And you want to talk about the most moving experiences of my life, going to Hiroshima had to be near the top because it's hell on earth. I mean, and I said, let's assume that 1 billion people are saved at the end of time, which is more generous than most Christians would say, right?
Than 144,000.
way more than 144,000 people, right? And that's half of Christianity.
Wow.
Okay. So let's just say 1 billion are saved. That means that God has to kill 6 billion, which is the equivalent of 300 nuclear bombs being dropped on humanity for the next, I think it's 27 years is what the math works out to. And you're like, is that what we're hoping for?
Yeah.
Because when I look at who people expected Jesus to be, they wanted Jesus to be a military conqueror.
Right.
Drop some Hiroshimas. Would slay all of the enemies. They wouldn't say Hiroshima because they didn't know.
Right.
But would slay all of their enemies and would hold them up as the right people. And I said, I'm afraid that if we hope for this military commander to return and kill all of our enemies, we're going to be vastly disappointed just like we were the first time.
Right.
That's what got me removed. Oh. So I stand by that.
Yeah.
And I understand that was tough for them. I, you do the best you can with Revelation.
You know, and I obviously, we're not talking to that person who struggle with, or those group of people who struggle with that idea. But I have a hard time understanding being opposed to a theology that includes more people. Theology that's like a bit more generous. Like, well, maybe there aren't 6 billion people who are going to die.
Well, and this is, if I got to heaven, right? And whatever heaven is, I'm not 100% sure. I believe that we will be reunited with Christ and with our family at the end of time. I don't know much beyond that, right?
Right, right.
If we get there and Jesus talks to me, I would love it if Jesus said, you know, Craig, you're a little too generous.
Yeah.
Your idea of my love was a little bigger than mine.
Yeah.
And I doubt that'll happen, but I'm acting that way because I really want to... I want to try and be more generous than God.
Right.
It's not going to happen. That's impossible for me to be, but that's what I'd rather shoot for. As opposed to what I picture happening when I get to heaven is, you know, Craig, you had a real small vision of what my love for humanity actually was.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, I know, I was trying, I'm trying my best.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, that's really what I picture it as.
That's awesome. And that leads us exactly to metaphor, right? Because metaphors are always going to fall short of the reality.
And that's great. And that's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with them falling short of the reality.
Yep.
As long as you remember their metaphors.
Exactly.
For instance, when I did that Revelation series, the Revelation begins by talking about Jesus as the Alpha and the Omega.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that metaphor. And I wish the church could adopt that metaphor, because what the church has done is they've taken that metaphor of Alpha and Omega mean that Jesus was there at the beginning and the end.
Hmm.
And they've made it read that Jesus was there 6,000 years ago, and that Jesus will be there at the end of time, which is very soon.
Right.
But the Alpha and the Omega is, well, whenever the universe began, which some scientists say is 14 billion years ago.
Right.
It doesn't really matter because Jesus was there.
Right.
And scientists are telling us that in about 4.5 billion years, the sun will eat itself alive and combust or something,
the earth. Yeah.
And they say that the earth is temporary. And I say, yeah. And because Jesus is the Omega, he will be there as well, too. And that's what I love about metaphors. And the moment you can see how that goes into literal translation, how it becomes pretty dangerous.
Right.
And it reduces who God is even further than the metaphor.
And furthermore, it divides people who interpret the metaphor differently. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like, it does. Like, unfortunately, the interpretation you gave includes people who may have a young earth view, and it also includes people who may have an evolutionary view of the world. It includes them both in the same idea. But when we start, when we start robbing the metaphor of its power, it starts dividing people left and right.
Well, and when we start adding words to scripture, that's when I start getting nervous. Like, if somebody were to read Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega, right?
Yep.
They would say they feel like they need to add Jesus, who is the Alpha, which was 6,000 years ago.
Right. Just in case you're wondering.
And the Omega, which could be next year. Like, it doesn't help.
It doesn't.
But that's why it's important to recognize them as metaphors. Like, and that's where I've found it to be very helpful.
Yeah.
And every bit of language that we have for God has to be a metaphor.
Yeah. When I first started listening to the sermon this last week, I'm not going to lie. I was like, oh man, where is Craig going with this high priest thing? Because high priest has always struck me as that thing where the pastor gets up in front of the church and just reiterates what everyone already believes, but no one exactly knows why it's important. It's kind of one of those things, where he just starts firing people up like, Jesus is our high priest, and everyone just loves it, just eats it up. I've always been the kind of person who, like, okay, so why are we screaming about Jesus being our high priest? Like, why does this matter?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I you went a completely different route, and I appreciated that about it, because I don't know. I've always kind of been, when people literally interpret Jesus as our high priest, been like, so what?
Yeah.
I don't get this. Yeah. Why does this matter?
I think it matters because it's faith in the goodness of the universe. And there is a lot of terrible stuff that happens in this universe. And I don't deny that. I'm not saying any of that. But I think that the net the net is positive. And when you look at what it is that this metaphor is that I really trust that a high priest is there reconciling humanity with God. And this author comes along and says it chapter after chapter after chapter that says, hey, God is that guy. We're not actually being reconciled to God.
Right.
He's angry with us. God is actually the one doing the reconciling. It's all done. And because of that, we should be people who are more quick to hope and to show faith in others and also to love others. Because that's kind of showing what it is to have faith in being a high priest.
Right.
I've got a story that I'm going to use in some of their sermon at some point. But my brother-in-law just went to Starbucks last week and he went through the drive-thru and he said, I'll have a peppermint mocha, please. And the barista came on the drive-thru and said, we're sorry, sir. We're out of peppermint mocha. And he said, oh, okay, I'll have a white chocolate, yada, yada, yada thing. Right. She drives up to the window. This is at 11:30. Starbucks opened at 6:00, right? He drives up at 11:30 to the window and she says, sir, this drink is on the house. And he says, why? She says, you're the only person who didn't yell at me because we were out of peppermint mocha. And I picture this woman for 5 hours just enduring screaming as people are trying to say, where's my peppermint mocha, right?
You're out of peppermint mocha.
If you are mad that Starbucks does not have the peppermint mocha, you are not trusting that Jesus is your high priest.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's just impossible. There are bigger issues in the world. And you start to recognize with Jesus being the high priest that there is there are bigger issues that need to be dealt with. And you're able to absorb those smaller inconveniences and be like, this isn't a big deal.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, I love it. That's awesome.
You're the first person I've told that story.
But let's be honest. I mean, peppermint mocha. You had one job, Starbucks. You had one job.
Just don't yell at baristas, is all I'm saying.
Maybe, like, maybe.
You can be mad about it. Go drive off in your car somewhere and just scream at the heavens. Scream at God.
Jesus is my high priest.
Yeah. But it's I think that's a small story, but it's a story that exemplifies it, because I think so much of us live in a world where we're just like, the world's out to get us.
Yeah.
The world's out to get us. And here comes the author of Hebrews that says, look, because Jesus is this, it changes everything.
I love it. This is going to be maybe a little sidetracked, but I wanted to talk about it because I think it's going to be fun. Can we just talk about how much Christian music massively misses the point?
Did you pick up on that from the sermon, or is this just in general?
Like, there are artists that I think of that exemplify this idea of God being for us. Chris Tomlin is one. And then you instantly go to Kendrick Lamar, and Kendrick Lamar's song is so much more powerful than Chris Tomlin. Like, it blows it out of the water. And I don't know, man.
So would you say it's more inspired, Garrett?
Yes. I mean, hands down.
I got to ask you a question now. How can you say it's more inspired when there's expletives and it's talking about some very dark subject matter, from the idea of, like, it's about police brutality, racially motivated police brutality?
Yep.
How would you say that it's more inspired than a worship song?
I would say, I mean, this is a very subjective thing, but I would say the Kendrick Lamar song moves me because it's true on a deep level. It's true on a societal level. Mm-hmm. It's true on a human level. Chris Tomlin. Okay. We're going to offend some people here, but that is literally just a bunch of Christian cliches strung together to C, G, and D. You know what I mean? Like, it's Christianese, man. And I don't know. I'm not moved, or it doesn't cause me to analyze my white privilege in a way that the Kendrick Lamar song does.
Well, and this is, so I mentioned the Chris Tomlin on purpose because I wanted people to recognize that the similarity between the lyrics are very, very similar, right?
Almost
they're
exact.
Very close, which shocked me when I was looking at it.
Right.
But then I'm like, but I'm drawn to the Kendrick Lamar over and over again because it actually risks something and says something.
Hmm.
Now, if somebody here is listening to Chris Tomlin and they like Chris Tomlin, I'm not trying to discredit
or devalue
your worship experience.
Me either.
But
that's a personal thing. It's just not my favorite.
And,
yeah.
And that's it. And I celebrate that you're happy with that music. For me though, what I found is like Kendrick Lamar took a big risk in that album and specifically with that song.
Yeah.
Talking about some pretty difficult things and refused to back down from what he found to be true. And then he couched it all in hope and faith.
Yep.
And you're like, this is one of the most inspired songs I've heard in the last 10 years.
And he points to a God who is moving humanity as a whole towards goodness, towards hope, towards faith. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it. Or I don't know. I feel like that Chris Tomlin song is the whole point of that song is that Christianity's God is better than any other God, right?
Well, there's shades of that. So the lyrics go, our God is greater, our God is stronger, our God
is
higher than any other.
You're right, exactly.
And we have a friend that's in the ministry. We haven't asked if he can use his name, so I'm just going to say a friend who changes the lyrics to say, it sucks to be Hindu, it sucks to be Muslim. Like, it's... I understand that, right?
Yeah, it is sort of the insinuation.
I can see how if I was not a Christian and I came in and heard that, came in and heard that song, that's exactly what I'd hear.
I would feel the same way.
And that's not what Chris Tomlin intended.
Right.
That and if people like that song, great. We don't sing it at Paradox for that reason. It's actually on our band list because we know that that's how it would be perceived by people who aren't Christian.
Right.
That being said, I've led that song a bunch, and then about 4 years into, 2 or 3 years into leading it, I started to realize, oh, this doesn't send the message we're going for.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, no, I don't know. Sometimes I just feel like I don't know if there should be such a thing as Christian music. You know, we were just talking about the idea of Kendrick Lamar being more inspired than Chris Tomlin. And that's, that's a subjective thing. But I mean, why can't someone get up on a Saturday at Paradox and drop Kendrick Lamar in it, you know? And
So there's appropriate words and inappropriate words, right?
Definitely.
One of the best things I've seen recently online is Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's this author. He talks about why white people shouldn't say the N-word during hip hop concerts. And the way he says it is he says that that's a word that has been used to establish a hierarchy that we've all agreed is unjust. And he says the fact that you miss out on one thing in your life gives you a window into what we're missing out all the time being African-American in the U.S. It's like, it's so well put.
That is. That's...
So there are words that are appropriate and inappropriate.
Right.
And at Paradox, being in a church setting, there are appropriate words and inappropriate words. There was one time I asked a worship leader to possibly think about doing Drunken Love because we were doing Song of Solomon.
Yeah, right.
They said they didn't feel like it was the right thing. I looked at it again. I don't think it was. But, you know, we guess. We do our best to guess and try to figure out what fits the environment and what doesn't.
Yeah.
There are some Kendrick Lamar songs I would love to do. There are others that it would be too far.
Yeah, and maybe
it's not because it's less spiritual. It's
exactly.
Just because it's of the environment that it's in.
And two, I think I didn't necessarily refer to exactly to Kendrick Lamar, but this sense of that we have to sing worship songs at church because they explicitly talk about God.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how necessary that is.
Well, we got a few people giving us feedback. When we had a song that didn't mention God explicitly in our Easter service, and they brought that up, and you know, you could double down and say like, well, we'll sing whatever you want. We're Paradox, all this stuff.
Right.
And I'll tell you, that's where my brain went immediately. I'm a defensive creature and that's what I struggle with. But then it's like, well, why not just give them a sentence that explains where we are and what we're trying to do with the music this week? And then I found that people will go a long ways if they feel like you actually cared about it. For instance, you know, with this weekend at Paradox, Christian and Liz sang songs that had metaphors in them. Mm-hmm. None of them were supposed to be sung along with because they're all songs that they had written.
Right.
But they explained the metaphors that were there. And I got up and I introduced it and said like, hey, we're going to sing some songs that aren't to be sung along with. There are songs that are that have metaphors, so I want you to pay attention to the metaphors because we're going to be talking about that.
That's cool.
yeah, the intro came from getting that feedback.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're trying our best to learn and figure out what it is that people are looking for in a worship service.
Yeah.
And we've tried some things that have done well, and most of the things that we tried don't do well, and we try and evaluate and go from there. So, yeah.
Who do you feel like is, are some artists right now, it could be Christian or non-Christian, who inspire you the most?
I mean, Kendrick Lamar, just because we're talking about him, is the first one that comes to mind. The new Sam Smith album I just listened to recently.
It's fantastic.
Oh my gosh. It's like the song about him talking to God and where he's in love with another man.
Yeah. Like, I can't remember what that song's called.
It's called Him.
Him.
It's so good. Yeah. It's just like, it's a powerful, beautiful song. I would say that's 100% inspired. What else is there? I mean, Beyonce's Lemonade is one. I mean, we talked about that when we did the Song of Solomon.
Yeah.
That was last year.
I really liked the new Bon Iver CD.
Oh, yes.
The album.
That's really moving to me. It's so moving to me, and yet none of the words make sense.
Yeah.
On purpose, which is strange.
Yeah, full of metaphor, man.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's... I think that we as Christians feel a lot more comfortable if biblical metaphors are said a lot in a song.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I found doing worship music for all these years. And the truth is I've moved more and more away from that because I'm much more interested in inspiration.
Mm.
And sometimes that inspiration happens within the Christian context, and sometimes it happens outside of it. And that's the story that's affirmed within scripture over and over again.
How about some like Christian musicians? I don't know if they necessarily inherently call themselves Christian, but who enjoy.
So I love Gunger. They would really hesitate at me calling them Christian musicians.
Right.
But
they at least explicitly talk about God.
Yeah. They're artists that write about God who are Christian.
Yeah.
Well, I don't even know if they would be comfortable with that term anymore.
Right.
But, Sleeping at Last is a guy, Ryan O'Neill, who's a Christian who writes music.
Yeah.
Switchfoot has often said that we are Christians who are in a band together.
Yeah.
Which is different than Christian music.
Definitely.
People that would have no problem saying they're explicitly Christian. The song So Will I by Hillsong United, I thought was really well written and really well done. It surprised me. My wife showed it to me and I didn't want to like it, and I did. It's really profound the way they write it and they talk about God. It's one of the best worship songs I've heard them write in a long time.
Yeah, same.
So,
do you like Josh Girls at all?
I do. Yeah. I do. I've seen him a couple times.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah. What about you? Who do you like?
Right now, man, I mean, we just went to the concert. I love Noah Gunderson.
Yeah.
I think I've listened to that album more this year than any album. I love Bon Iver. I love the Lumineers.
So there's a story I want to tell about Noah Gunderson.
Yeah, hit it.
You and I went to a concert of his at the club. Bardot.
Yes, we did.
Remember, it was just him and Abby. It was acoustic guitar and violin.
Yep.
And he sings this song, Jesus, Jesus.
Yeah,
right?
Jesus, Jesus.
And he sings it. And do you remember, it was you and me, and then we were sitting next to some other people too. Do you remember who was sitting there? It was
Kyle Dever and Jay Murdoch.
And Jay Murdoch.
Yeah.
And then I thought there was one other pastor.
There was. He's not a pastor anymore, but his name is John Wheeler.
Oh, okay. Yep. So there's five pastors there. And do you want to tell people what Jesus is about for anyone that hasn't heard it?
Yeah. It's, the idea is sort of like Noah sitting down with Jesus and asking him some of like the hard questions, like to resolve how Buddhists die. What about gay people? Just kind of like bearing his soul to Jesus
and it's
over a cup of coffee. And it is one of like the most moving, beautiful, true songs that I've ever heard.
And it's more of a lament, right?
Yep.
Like a lament against Christianity and against God. And I wouldn't say it's pro Jesus by any means.
But, no.
Right? And there's an F-bomb and all this stuff.
Yep.
And what I thought was so interesting when we saw it was there was the five youth pastors there, right?
Yeah.
Like right on the front row.
Yeah, we were.
And I'm sitting there thinking, does he know? Does he know that we're like all pastors? And the thing that I think that moment taught me was that we were all drawn to that, and it's particularly that song.
Yeah.
Because we felt like it was so honest. And within church work, you have to deal with a lot of BS.
Yep.
And to hear that honesty was something that we would drive all the way to LA for.
Yeah.
Over and over again to hear, because it was just like this refreshing breath of air. I mean, yeah. I don't know how you interpret it, but
no, it's exactly it. It reminded me of a story when I was at Walla Walla. There we did a week of prayer, worship, whatever you want to call it. And the very last, the idea was giving students the space to talk about their doubts of God. Mm-hmm. And the last student who spoke, his name was Michael, I'll never forget, was such an honest talk, and there was literally no resolution in the talk, which, yeah. you know, obviously is the best type of doubt yeah, talk.
Especially for doubts.
Just yeah. leave it wide open. Yeah. And he ended with that song, and I'll never forget, the president of the university came up to me and the chaplain at the time and told us how disappointed he was with how we ended the week of worship. I couldn't believe it. You just completely missed the power of that song and how many people can resonate with it and find it true. But yeah, but no, I
so the president didn't see it. He didn't like see the value of it
at all. No, he wanted, the chaplain at the time to get up and
put the Christian ending on it.
Well, like get like an altar call essentially.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, like don't stay in your doubt. Come to, you know, it's like, no man.
Have you seen the movie Facing the Giants?
Is it a Christian movie?
It's a Christian movie about a football team.
Definitely not.
Okay. Well, I'm pretty sure you can guess the whole movie at that point when I say it's a Christian movie about a football team.
Fourth quarter.
This guy's a drunk. He's a drunk. His wife's about to leave him. He's the coach of his son's football team.
There it is.
And they're losing every game. He gives his life to God. His son's football team starts winning. The wife comes back. He gives up drinking and they win the state championship, right?
That sounds pretty biblical.
That is a lie.
Yeah.
It is a lie.
Sure
is. And we have no problem. Sorry, you're getting me worked up.
No, this is good.
We have no problem selling this lie over and over and over again. And yeah. everybody knows it's a lie.
Right.
But it sounds good. So people are like,
makes people feel good.
Just do that.
Exactly.
Just do that. Just tell people that it's all going to be okay.
Yep.
What if it doesn't? What if it's not?
Yeah.
Like, that's where I get so frustrated, because yes, it's convenient and yes, it's comfortable, but it's not honest.
It's not honest. It's not true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is the power of that Noah song, is how raw it is. And what I've noticed through, you know, we've seen him a bunch of times, I think you've told me this, is that he seems to get angrier and angrier the more he sings.
That's Kyle that's pointed that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kyle was the one that said it. Like every time we saw him, because I think we've seen him like four or five times
at least. Year. Yeah.
Every time we've seen him play that song, Jesus, Jesus, it gets angrier and angrier.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh man.
You're like, wow, this is real.
And at the same time, it's just so nice to hear.
It is.
Because it's the best lament I've heard written in my lifetime, period.
Yep.
Like, it's just a phenomenal, phenomenal piece of songwriting.
I think one of my favorite, if we're to use the word Christian songs, is Phil Wickham's song. And I'm not a huge fan of a lot of Phil Wickham songs, but we did this song for Bible Camp, Divine Romance.
Yes.
One of the yes. best articulated songs of the idea of a relationship with God that I've ever heard written.
Because it takes it out of the romantic relationship metaphor.
Yes.
And it's like,
finally, man. Oh,
we needed it so bad.
Finally.
And it completely places it in a different category.
Yep.
Which is how I see it.
Yeah. Jesus isn't your boyfriend anymore.
Yeah. Well, and it's just, it clarifies that by just calling it divine. I mean, it's so divine romance. And
right.
It simplifies it so well. And yep. It just talks about it in a different way. So I couldn't agree more. That is one of the best songs that was written for praise and worship by an artist who had no problem saying I'm a Christian artist.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a
good call. Good callback.
But then I feel like you just did it like a Joshua, you know, like he had divine romance. And then we took like three steps back in consciousness with his next album.
I kept buying his albums, 'cause I was like, oh, it's going to go back to the other stuff. Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's selling a lot more records and you know, it's hard to make it as a musician. So I'm not going to judge him or anything like that,
yeah.
as much as it's been, it was sad. The letdown on the second album was really tough for me.
It was for me too. Yeah. I forget what, I think that album was called The Ascension or
Heaven and Earth. I think
Heaven and Earth. That was it. But that was the one with Ascension on it.
I think so. Yeah.
I can't keep them straight.
Yeah, I can't either.
Somebody's going to write us an email that says, no.
Yeah, some like diehard Phil Wickham fan.
You can send us the email, yeah.
Is crying.
Yeah.
Phil?
Yeah, and that's what I found to be more and more valuable.
Yeah.
The more I've gotten older as a pastor as well, is just when people are willing to be honest, that's always valuable.
Yeah.
Always valuable.
And I think that matters not only in music, but it matters in our own Christianity and mm-hmm. our own ability to be honest with the scriptures. And yeah, man.
Yeah. Well, hey, I think we did it.
This is fun.
Yeah, that's it. So I don't know if it's just me and Garrett talking at this point to nobody, but we just appreciate anybody that's still listening.
Absolutely.
And we'll do this again maybe.
Tune in next week.
You know, whatever. We'll try to do it next week.
I'll still be a guest.
There you go. And then after the third time, we'll graduate you to a regular.
Let's leave people with Humble Beast.
Humble Beast.
Just be a humble beast.
Yeah, humble beast. Shout out to Propaganda. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next week.
See ya.